Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is September 20, 2019, and it's my birthday. How about that? And a lovely day it is here in Nashville. 75 degrees and clear as I speak with you here at 10 a.m. We've had 3 weeks of brutal temperatures and no rain. There will be not much of a fall garden this year. This will be the 41st of our podcast offerings since the spring of 2017. And we will continue to try to bring you programs about subjects related to conservation and the environment. We do this in part because these topics are rarely covered by traditional media sources. And when they are covered, they're not covered in any kind of comprehensive way. We hope to introduce you to many of the fine people who dedicate their lives to protecting the natural and cultural resources of our state and to bringing you enriching programs and experiences. In our second podcast that we recorded back in April of 2017, we interviewed Ward Weems. Ward, at that time, had recently retired as the Chief of Cultural Resources Management for the Tennessee State Park System. In that interview, we talked about several of the parks that are historic or archaeological areas, such as Red Clay or Fort Loudoun. In today's program, I talk with David Britton. David is the park manager for Dunbar Cave and Port Royal State Parks near Clarksville, Tennessee. These two parks certainly have a great deal of natural beauty, but their main importance has to do with their place in Tennessee history, historic and prehistoric. David is a historian by training and a pretty good storyteller. I sure hope my interview with him will entice you to visit these interesting places. So please enjoy my interview with David Britton. David Britton, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
David, it's great to have you. Thank you for coming over here to White Oak Drive to, have a little talk. David, I'm going to introduce you to my audience. You're presently the park area manager for Dunbar Cave and Port Royal State Parks.
That's correct.
Up in the Clarksville area.
That's correct.
So I hope we can talk a little bit more about what's going on up there.
Sure. Yeah.
Before we do that, though, I want to talk just generally about yourself and how you got into a career in conservation. So where did you grow up, and tell us about all that?
Well, my family is originally from Clarksville.
Okay.
I was born in Knoxville. My folks were in grad school, and spent the first half of my childhood in Gallatin, Tennessee, and then folks relocated to Clarksville for a job and brought us closer to the grandparents and stuff like that. And I spent the latter half of my childhood there. And all through my childhood, though, going to parks, going to historic sites especially, was a huge component of our dynamic as a family. My mom was a historical interpreter for Bansker Station in Goodlettsville.
That's in the Goodlettsville City Park.
That's right. Yeah.
Is it the Moss Wright Park?
Yeah,
yes.
Moss Wright Park.
Right.
Yeah. So I could spend a lot of days there, and going to various reenactments with her, and then my father's also the quintessential armchair historian, and so grew up with that type of dynamic. And it probably wasn't until I was in my early 20s that it really kind of clicked as being a reasonable career path. At that time, I was working at a guitar manufacturing facility, and I was doing well there and became a charter member of the Port Royal State Park Friends Group.
Okay.
And so I was involved with that and had met Ward Weems and Charlie Tate at that time, and Dan Weber, and they all encouraged me to pursue a career in parks. But before that point, I really didn't even know it to be an option, even though I'd had plenty of experiences with rangers and such growing up.
Right.
And then with the park manager at Dunbar Cave at that time, he said, well, I got a a low-paying maintenance position if you want to jump in. And so I did. And so that was almost 14 years ago. I started off as what was then a seasonal full laborer position.
Conservation worker.
Yeah, not even a conservation worker. Okay. It's even lower than that.
Okay.
And it worked my way up to a few different positions like that. And then in early 2013, I became a park ranger at Bicentennial Capitol Mall State Park.
All right.
And so I was there until just 2 years ago, and then started at Dunbar Cave in Port Royal again, but this time as the park manager.
I presume that you went to school. I know you went to Austin Peay.
That's correct, yeah.
You were going to Austin Peay while you were working there as a park maintenance sort
That's
of a guy.
That's right, yeah. All right. I went, got my degree in early American history.
Fantastic. You know, it's interesting. Historically, the track for park folks has been in natural resources types
typically,
of fields,
yeah.
Or strictly park and recreation administration. Right. You are, I guess, a new crowd of folks in the parks field that have training in historic preservation.
Correct. Yeah. Well, there are a few of us in comparison to the 200 some odd uniformed people in Tennessee State Parks. There might be less than six of us that have this particular sort of skill set. But, you know, it's cultural resource protection is 50% of our mandate, you know, as a agency. Yeah. And so that's where I definitely focus my efforts, you know, into, and we need more of us. So,
well, you know, virtually every park has features in it that have historical significance. If only the CCC era cabins.
Sure.
You know, not to say only, but those are significant. But yeah, the parks consist of a lot of rare historic features.
Absolutely. You know, Director Robertson, Mike Robertson, he says frequently that, you know, every park has history. You know, he'll ask seasonals at seasonal end service who works at a historical park, and nobody raises their hand. He's like, you're all wrong. Y'all work at historical parks.
Exactly.
But, you know, in Tennessee State Parks, though, we have a really, really unique makeup of important stories that helped craft what Tennessee is and has become. And it's a really unique opportunity to be able to get to visit these places.
Well, yeah. I mean, just even if you just go to Pinson Mounds, I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah.
That's a world-class historic archaeological area.
Yeah.
Folks, if you've never been to Pinson Mounds, you really need to go and see that.
Absolutely. It's, I mean, especially there in the flat floodplain of Western Tennessee, and that mound sticks up, you know, it's like a sore thumb. I mean, it's
an amazing thing. Saul's Mound.
Yeah.
So, David, I want to talk about Dunbar Cave and Port Royal. And there's so much going on up there. And I had not been up there until about a year. Well, I've been up there many times in the remote past. But recently we went up about a year ago.
The first time I met you was there.
That's exactly right. I was up there that day to interview Dwayne, at the university. Dwayne Estes, who's the field botanist there, who heads up the Southeastern Grasslands Initiative.
That's correct.
And I was interviewing him there. And as long as we were there in Clarksville, I said, well, you've got to go by and see Dunbar Cave. And just happened that you were you were doing your inspection of the cave area
and
your patrol. And I introduced myself, and we've had a friendship going ever since.
Yes, sir.
So tell us just in a general way about Dunbar Cave for those that may never have been there.
So it's actually one of our smaller parks. You know, we're 144 acres, and we're also in the middle of Clarksville, Tennessee, which Money Magazine just declared to be the number one city to live in America.
Isn't that fun?
We'll see how that works out with us. But Dunbar Cave was home to a variety of different native people, indigenous people, over thousands of years. and very specifically to the Mississippian people, which existed, you know, around 1,000 years ago thereabouts, it was a very sacred place. And inside Dunbar Cave, they left artwork on the walls. Now, cave art in Tennessee is not a rarity per se, but Dunbar Cave is the only place in the world that you can actually visit any sort of cultural dark zone cave art in a public setting like this. And so that is our, in my opinion, our reason for being at this point. This is what we focus our efforts on, is to preserve and protect and interpret that particular resource, that Mississippian cave art.
So interesting. You know, during the time of my tenure in parks, that cave was closed to the public.
Yes.
Only, I mean, I've never been in there, and I was the director of state parks, so it was closed. I guess I probably could have insisted on going in, sure, had I wanted to, but you have made a specific effort to make it open to the public, and but for guided tours.
Correct. Right. So they had been doing guided tours, you know, when I was there as a maintenance person, but one of my problems with or beefs, so to speak, with any sort of historical site, museum, is sometimes the lack of consistency and professionalism in what they offer. And so that was one of the very first things that I wanted to tackle when I got there, is that we need to make these cave tours consistently offered, you know, in our time frame. Because there's nothing worse than like looking up a museum or a park on Google Maps and you drive out of the way to get there and it's supposed to be open, but it's not.
Right.
I mean, I think all of us have experienced that at some point.
Right.
And so I certainly didn't want that to happen there. So we've made a huge concerted effort to figure out what would be the best approach toward providing the most access while also ensuring that the cave has ample conservation
exactly.
periods, you know.
Right.
So yeah, well, we put a lot of effort into that, and we've come out good with that, I think.
Tell us about the inside of that cave. You've mentioned that there are pictographs,
yes,
on the walls. Are there also natural features that are worthwhile?
Absolutely, seeing? Yeah. You know, so it's a karst, you know, formation, and that it's carved by water over millions of years. You know, about 3.5 million years ago is when this cave formation process started at Dunbar. And part and parcel to that is speleothems, you know, stalactites and stalagmites and rimstone dams and all those sorts of things. Now, Dunbar Cave was commercialized beginning in the early 1870s, and it was heavily abused during that time. So what we believe that pretty much a standard practice for souvenir taking was to remove stalactites, because lots of them have been broken off over the years. On top of that, passages were dug out to make it easy to navigate through the cave, at least in the historical tour area. But also lots and lots and lots of graffiti was left on the walls too. We would certainly call it graffiti today, and it would definitely be a misdemeanor, but you know, now it's a historical resource. So you're actually going to
probably... Yeah, if it says Davy Crockett was here, you know, I mean...
those are the ones, yeah. Most of that, the natural component in being completely transparent, has been destroyed at some point in there. Now, there are certainly rooms that we go to on tours that are lesser touched and kind of helps showcase that component of the cave.
Okay.
There, as far as walking through the front of the cave, the signatures on the walls and the Native American artwork are definitely the draws.
Okay. So... you know, we hear a lot about bats in Tennessee. Yeah. Do we have bats in that cave?
Or? We do. Okay. We have few.
Okay.
You know, white nose syndrome was detected at the cave, you know, I forget exactly when, but I think around 2010, 29 thereabouts.
Okay.
And the cave was shut down according to TDEC protocol at that time. And as our understanding of that disease has increased, realizing that, you know, we're not really certain that we necessarily have a whole lot of impact on it, but we're still trying to do our due diligence as far as ensuring we're not encouraging people to take shoes with our dirt on it into other caves and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there was a concern that people were actually a vector of the disease,
correct.
Right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And I'm certainly not an expert on
right,
that,
right,
but I know that over the years we have loosened up a little bit, but created more focused educational efforts. We've basically figured out that the most effective means of stopping people from transmitting it is to teach them about it, educate them on it.
So, David, as people go to Dunbar Cave, one of the prominent features is the deck that is out in the cave opening. I guess you'd say it was a concrete deck, or maybe it's fieldstone. And it's so interesting that we're listening each night to Ken Burns' country music history.
Yeah.
And Roy Acuff plays prominently in that. And absolutely. I know he played prominently at Dunbar Cave.
Absolutely. Yeah, he purchased the cave in the park in 1948 and turned it into a country music park. And if you can imagine Opryland, for those of us that remember Opryland, imagine Opryland without the roller coasters and the rides, and you had Dunbar Cave at that time. You know, with darts and bowling and paddle boats and horse riding and amphitheater.
Is that when the lake was built?
The lake was built in the, there's an earlier version in the 1920s, but the version that's there today was built in the 1930s.
Okay.
And, but yeah, anybody who was anybody in the country music scene played there at Dunbar Cave.
So they had big band concerts and other sorts of music concerts right there at the mouth of the cave.
Right, yeah.
In the summertime, where the air was cool coming
out of the cave, blowing 56 degrees out of that the mouth of the cave there.
And you all recently had a concert event at that site.
Correct.
Tell us about that.
So that was the annual Cooling at the Cave event. That's an event that our Friends of Dunbar Cave sponsor and help put on. I mean, they do, I would say, 95% of the work with that. But it's an opportunity to kind of recreate an afternoon, hot afternoon, at the mouth of the cave and listen to big band music.
I think that you had posted a live observation of it on Facebook, and I was so impressed with the quality of the music.
Yes.
That I heard in that 30-second clip or something like that.
The Cumberland Winds.
Okay.
Yeah, they're out of Clarksville.
And it's truly a big band.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's I don't know how many pieces exactly it was, but I mean, it was everything you would expect.
And set up with very little amplification.
I think the only amplification was on the vocalist.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But man,
but the mouth
big
of the cave
sound.
Projects. You know, you put something in it, it has its own bullhorn effect.
And I suspect if people wanted to search for that on Facebook, they could probably find it.
Yeah, if you
that.
Go to the Dunbar Cave Facebook page and scroll down to the post,
it'd still be there. And it's really fun to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Other features of Dunbar Cave, I know you've got some hiking trails. Mm-hmm. Up. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so there's about 3 miles worth of hiking trails. We're hopefully going to be working over this next year, doing some improvement and rerouting of those. Because they're getting to be about 40 years old, and some of them were laid out improperly to begin with. So we're working on those. But the most recent addition to that trail system was through the grassland, or the prairie restoration. And
I want to talk in detail about that a little bit.
I would say that the trail system is probably what the majority of people come to the park for during the day. You get a lot of people, that's their daily afternoon run. So they come and go to the park.
And you are right adjacent to the Clarksville Municipal Golf Course.
Correct.
So there's although the park is just a couple hundred acres, with that golf course added to it, there's a big amount of green space there.
Absolutely, yeah. And in fact, it is all the original park that Acuff and before owned. Acuff created the golf course.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Right.
Okay.
As well as the Clarksville Sports Complex on the backside. All of that together was the original park. And when it was sold off by McKay King in 1972, state purchased what is now Dunbar Cave State Park. Right. And then the city of Clarksville purchased that golf course.
And then later, did the city later get the property for the sports complex up on the top?
I don't know enough.
You know, that property was a part of a Land and Water Conservation Fund grant to develop those ball fields and you have up there.
Interesting.
All right. So, I've already said that we were up there a year ago to talk to Dwayne Estes about the grasslands, mm-hmm. and learned at that time about the planning to make a grassland prairie element in Dunbar Cave. And Beth and I took the little tour, the drive a little around the backside of the park to look at that property, which is how many acres?
I don't know the entirety 20, off the top of my head. 30 acres. What we have planted is around 15.
Okay. Yeah. Beautiful pasture land.
Yeah, it had been pasture land for probably at least 150 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so tell us about what's happened there.
So just to cut to the chase of it, we have reestablished this prairie ecosystem that, you know, that Dr. Estes, Dwayne Estes with SGI, is so fond of. And it goes around, and I'll say this is entirely his brainchild, so I don't want to take any credit on that at all.
Right.
When he had the idea for this at Dunbar Cave, the Friends Group had just facilitated that purchase of that property for the park. And so it's kind of a perfect coming together of opportunities there. And so they began that process of reestablishing it. And, you know, for me, it's especially interesting, you know, because again, my background is not in the natural sciences.
Right.
So I've just had a lot of on-the-job training over several years about it. But what's interesting for me about it and speaks to me about it is the historical connections with this prairie, that so much of what Dwayne's doing is based in historical resources of 200 to 250 years ago, that we have to do primary material research in order to find these descriptions, whether it's through Revolutionary War land grants to Revolutionary War soldiers out of North Carolina or travel narratives or whatever. But they describe this this ecosystem that's present, and it is totally contrasting to the romanticized version of what we've been led to believe that Tennessee and Kentucky was,
right,
which is the, you know, massive arboreal forest, you know, from end to end.
Right.
And so it's a really exciting opportunity to be able to interpret along with the Mississippian component at Dunbar Cave. And we can say that this is very likely what Mississippian people here knew this area to look like.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole world of interpretive opportunities coming out of this.
So there was a process involved in changing that back into a prairie.
Yes.
That it's sort of...
It's ongoing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Initially, you have... What you had there was a pasture that consisted of European grasses. That's
correct. Yes.
So in order to establish native grasses, those European grasses have to be done away with.
That's correct. Then the multiple applications of an herbicide, and generally they try not to, but because this was all Johnson grass and fescues and stuff like that, and it was
really aggressive
stuff.
Yeah.
And with multiple treatments of that, they came in, I think they seeded around 50 some odd species, and they're hoping to increase that species count to over 250, I believe, in the end. So that they went in the first year, they planted, you didn't see a whole lot, but then that first year that everything had finally had opportunity to winter over, it bloomed out like crazy. We had a bunch of black-eyed Susans planted in there, and everybody loved that.
Right.
And it was kind of an intentional attention grabber.
Sure.
This year, it's a little less flashy, but we're having to fight the Johnson grass pretty hard right now.
And privet hedge and honeysuckle.
Well, luckily we've had these recurring volunteer days every month, partnerships between SGI and the park,
right.
And it's just getting people out there to pull privet and cut kudzu or, you know, Japanese honeysuckle or whatever it might be, and that's had a really good positive net effect, and that we're starting to see less and less and less privet and less kudzu and less honeysuckle. The Johnson grass is still our number one nemesis right now.
Sure, sure. Are there opportunities for citizens to be involved with that? Tell
Absolutely.
Us about that.
Absolutely. So the last Saturday of every month is when we do a volunteer morning up there at the prairie. We usually put it on Facebook. You can find it in the Dunbar Cave events section.
Okay.
Or you just swing by the park, you know, that morning, last Saturday of every month, start around 8 o'clock. You'll have to fill out a volunteer form.
Do people just convene there at the park headquarters?
Or they will usually go ahead and meet up there at the prairie.
At the prairie, yes. Okay, which is on the back side of the
park. Back side of the park. But right. If you don't know where that is, you could always stop in the office and pick up a quick map. And,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'd encourage people to go up and check that out.
Absolutely.
It is really, really a fun thing.
Absolutely.
And really exemplary of what is going on in our state parks.
Yeah.
Throughout the state, people are doing those sorts of projects. Yeah. All right, so let's turn the page just a moment.
All right.
And talk about Port Royal. And I know that's dear to your heart because you've worked there for a good
it is.
Long time. And again, this is a place that is hugely important historically. Tell us the story of Port Royal.
How long do we have? the story of Port Royal is one that has changed a lot over the past several decades. Yeah, when in complete transparency, when the department first acquired Port Royal, it was through the efforts of protecting a covered bridge that at that time was significant because it was the original bridge. So we're talking 1970, 69, 70, 71. Well, right after the state acquired the property, the bridge fell. And so they recreated a 3/4 scale bridge. And that was steel, but was not the original bridge, you know. And that remained kind of the focal point. And my philosophy when it comes to preservation and protection is the same philosophy I applied towards making a historical argument, writing a paper, whatever it's going to be, is that you've got to be able to answer the question of so what. Well, this is an important historical place. Well, so what? Why does it matter to us? More importantly, why does it matter that we're pumping taxpayer dollars into its preservation and protection? And honestly, once that bridge came down, it opened up a new world of opportunity for that park to be able to actually answer that so what question with some substance.
Okay.
Other than this is a replacement of a replacement bridge. And by the way, that bridge fell in a flood.
The replacement bridge got washed out in the flood.
In fact, no bridge other than the current highway bridge built by TDOT in the 1950s has withstood the Red River flooding in history. So, so Port Royal in and of itself, though, was created in the late 1790s, 1797 specifically. It's a year after statehood that we became the state of Tennessee, and was created as this regional market, this regional trade center for planters to bring their tobacco to have it inspected per state law, load them on the flatboats, and then send those flatboats down to New Orleans. Then in 1838, Indian removal impacted Port Royal, and the Cherokee Indians were removed forcibly from their homeland by the U.S. government. And one of those routes of removal, the northern route, which is where the majority of Cherokee were removed, came right through Port Royal. So Port Royal is also the last place that the Cherokee Nation slept in the state of Tennessee. Fast forward a little further into the 1840s and 50s, and there's a revitalization of Port Royal by a few investors, and it was the home place of the Tennessee Agricultural School and Silk Mill, opportunity to manufacture silk for the first time in the state of Tennessee. And so Port Royal was this amazing example to understand Tennessee prior to the Civil War, and look at it through this lens of enslaved African Americans, white planters, and then Native Americans all coming together in this very unique, small, albeit very small, right, spot here in northern Middle Tennessee.
So Port Royal is about 25 or 30 acres.
30 acres, yeah.
Okay, which is, if not the smallest,
it's the smallest if you don't count Bicentennial Mall.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But it's a cute little place.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a Sylvan area. I mean, there's
absolutely
not a lot of building there.
No.
One major building, I'd say.
That's correct. Yeah, the only building that's from the town is the 1859 Masonic Lodge and General Store. And of course, there's, you know, public restrooms and a maintenance shop and such. But the that building is what we've been putting the majority of our effort into, and what we are planning on, and I say we, I'm referring to myself and my rangers there, you know, are to further shape Port Royal's interpretation down the road to specifically interpret flatboats. Flatboats are the mode of transportation that expanded the United States up through the first half of the 19th century. This is the way that the Donelson Party got to Nashville.
Right.
This is the way that Pittsburgh and Philadelphia are sending their goods down the Ohio River into Nashville and Kentucky and all the way to New Orleans.
Right.
And so we want to interpret those. We also want to interpret tobacco culture. Even though we don't necessarily want to promote people using tobacco, but tobacco in and of itself is this huge moment for Middle Tennessee and even Kentucky, it's beginning in the 1790s and culminating with the tobacco wars of the early 20th century that also hinged at Port Royal.
Tell us more about that. That's something I didn't know about.
Now, the tobacco wars, after the American Civil War was over, and there's now a vacuum of labor caused by the emancipation of enslaved African Americans, you see the beginning of the sharecropper system. But there's a continual momentum being made towards farmers attempting to organize, whether it be labor organization or simply just trying to get better prices for their goods, or being able to afford goods. All culminated towards the end of the 19th century when the James Buchanan Duke American Tobacco Company monopolized well over, I think it's 83% of all tobacco production in the United States, even though it was going against the Antitrust Act of 1893. And so what happened is a tobacco farmer at this time, in order to break even, he had to be able to sell his tobacco at 6 cents a pound. Well, Duke had worked it to where they had they were only offering 3 cents for prime, 2 cents for seconds, and 1 cent for the lugs, and the farmers got to call on that 3-2-1 and a cussin. And so there was a group organized that the plan was conceived at Port Royal, and it was organized by a man named Felix Ewing out of Cedar Hill, Tennessee, at Glen Raven, and they created the Dark Fire Planters Protective Association. And the idea was that they would get you to pledge your tobacco to them, and they were going to pull the tobacco and force the price to go up, and then they would sell.
I got it.
Well, in the process of this, if you didn't join this, you had unaffiliated groups, in this case the possum hunters, that did night riding, where they would visit your house under mask and gun and threaten you to do so. But it culminated in a murder taking place there at Port Royal in 1908. And even in Kentucky, the towns of Russellville and Hawkinsville taken by paramilitary forces during this time.
Wow. This property is there on the Red River. I mean, but the Red River doesn't, to me, look navigable at that place.
It's a good point.
And you're, what, about 2 miles upstream from the Cumberland River? Maybe
we
a little
are,
more?
At Port Royal. The Red River, or Port, let's see, Port Royal is, I think, 25 miles up from the mouth of the Red.
Oh, gee. Wow, yeah. I wouldn't have thought it was that.
Yeah.
As the crow flies, it wouldn't maybe.
The crow flies is 12 miles.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah.
But it winds around.
It's very sinuous. Yeah, it does a lot of winding.
Okay.
Well, and that's why flatboats that were built at the boatyard at Port Royal would have been built and then tied off and waited for the high tide to come in. High tide, but like the flood season. Which is typically December through May, is historically what they considered that to be.
So the water runs high enough to
exactly
to navigate.
Yeah, I mean the river seasonally probably quadruples in depth. It's multiple times. But yeah, this time of the year you can barely get a canoe down it.
Nice little swimming hole.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So you all are remodeling the Masonic Hall there.
Correct.
How far along are you, and when do you anticipate that's going to be done, and what's going to be there when it's
done? I've had to learn to quit answering the question of when are you going to be done, because my first answer was a year ago. But this building, again, is the only building left of the old town of Port Royal, and it is unfortunately been a victim of lots and lots and lots and lots of typical state Band-Aid repairs over the past 40 years or so. And it's a miracle the building's even standing. The fact that we have found out in 1890, the walls were pulling apart on the second floor and the porch fell off of it. Well, they repaired it. And then in 1893, the roof was blown off of it. They repaired it. And then in 1923, the top floor was blown off. And they re-roofed it at like a story and a half. And then the state acquired it, re-extended it. And just the series of bad repairs. Repairs that did not have historic preservation in mind. And so we've been going in with the idea of we want the downstairs to reflect 1860. Upstairs is where a park office will be. And traditionally, that had been a park ranger residence upstairs. And so none of us live on site any longer. We have no need for that. So we're moving our offices up there. Okay. And so this will enable us to create a general store, as it would have been in 1859, 1860, but it's combined with our visitor interaction point, okay. Our visitor center.
All right.
But repairing this building has been a labor of love. So we're trying to do things right, everything from having brick mortar sent off to labs and matched, and plaster sent off and matched, and windows made by hand, and just to bring that historical integrity back to it. So at this point, I'm hoping, crossing my fingers, that we'll be close to being done by the beginning of next season.
Okay, so this by the end of the winter.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. It sounds like a good wintertime project.
It is. It is an all-in wintertime project. Yeah. Last winter, that's about all we did. And so we, of course, with the summer season being so busy, taking people through the cave, pulling people out of the river, and that kind of thing. We haven't really been able to touch it all summer. So.
Well, I encourage people to go and visit Port Royal. If you're going from Nashville, go up 24, get off
exit 11.
Exit 11.
Turn right.
And it's, five or six miles yeah. from the interstate.
Yeah.
It's not a huge big deal, but it's a very pretty place for a picnic.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you want to swim in the river there, you can do that. It's relatively clean there in the river, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, no different than any other rural stream at this point.
Right.
Upcoming, we have an event that I would encourage people to take a look at is Port Royal by Lantern. This is probably the 12th year we've offered this event, and it does extremely well. It sells out, so I do encourage you to look at getting your tickets soon. But it is a half-mile hike through the woods at Port Royal, and you visit five different campfires with a first-person storyteller who tells you a story of some of Port Royal's creepier history. So it's a kind of semi-Halloween event, but it's family-friendly. I think the cost is $10 for adults and $6 for kids.
And when is this?
This will be October 25th and 26th.
Okay.
And tours run every 20 minutes, starting at 6 o'clock until 9 o'clock.
Okay.
On 25th and 26th.
Now, is this an event that you're doing with your friends organization there?
We don't have a friends organization at Port Royal
yet. Okay.
We hope to.
Okay.
But yeah, this is one entirely done by the staff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. That sounds like a tough thing to pull off.
We've been doing that one long enough, even when I was there before. So it's kind of a well-oiled machine now.
All right.
But yeah, it's fun.
So do you have any events upcoming at Dunbar Cave?
Yeah. September 28th. So that's a little over a week from now. We will host Dunbar Cave 1865. And the idea of this event is to recreate an evening at the mouth of the cave in the 19th century. So we will have people in 1865 attire mingling with you at the mouth of the cave. There will be dance and dance instruction this period to the time, just as they would have done. And then you can take a candlelit or lantern-lit tour of the cave. Which is a whole different, unique experience. I mean, the cave looks remarkably different by lantern light. Refreshments.
I'll bet.
But you can make reservations for that. Again, go to Facebook and find the event, or you can go to tnstateparks.com and find Dunbar Cave and look at the upcoming events section.
Well, Dunbar Cave State Park has its own Facebook page.
He does. Yep.
Okay. And your friend's organization has a Facebook page.
They do
in
as
addition
well.
To
yes.
that. Okay. So between those two pages, you ought to be able to find
you keep
whatever
up with
information.
Pretty much everything, anything that's going on. We right. try to stay pretty updated with that.
Well, encourage people to check out both Dunbar Cave and Port Royal.
Absolutely.
David, thank you so much for taking some time and meeting with us today.
Thank you so much
All
for
right.
having me.
Enjoyed it.